Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2021. I'm now here with Mark Gullick, who is, he's a writer on Countercurrents, but there is more to him than that. So, Mark, would you like to introduce yourself and just describe yourself for the audience?
Certainly. My name's Mark Gullick. As you can see, I'm 60, originally from London in England. I say London, England, because apparently there are about seven Londons in the USA, so, and there are a lot of Americans down here where I am, which is Costa Rica, where I am, where I relocated about almost six years ago. Really came over here for a break and just kept staying. Was intending to go back at some stage, and then the whole COVID thing sprang up almost 2 years ago, I guess now. And having watched the appalling things that are happening in across Europe and the Commonwealth, and England now, it seems, as well, or Britain, I suppose, the UK, I should say, I've just decided to stay put here, because as I speak, the only thing I have to do here in terms of COVID is wear a mask when I go to a store or get on a bus. That's it. There's no vaccine mandates. There's nothing. There's been no lockdown. It's comparatively free and easy, and yet has the lowest infection rate in the Americas. So they're doing it right, whatever they're doing. Personally, I've got a PhD, well, three degrees, all in philosophy, all from the University of Sussex. And yeah, that's me, essentially.
Sorry, hold on a sec. And could you tell us about the three degrees that you have? Could you describe them for me?
Yeah, the MA and the PhD were in straight philosophy. The BA was in philosophy with literature, and obviously a degree. It was a mixed bag. The master's degree, rather foolishly, I did on Heidegger's Being and Time, which I don't think was a terrific idea. Now I look back on it, because I don't speak German, speak or read German. But nevertheless, it got me conversant with Being and Time, which is just a towering book. Sorry, I'm just motorcycles here don't tend to have mufflers or baffles on them. And my doctorate was my supervisor. There's a man called Jeff Bennington, who was a friend and translator of Jacques Derrida.
And right.
He suggested to me that we were talking, I think we'd had a couple of seminars about the body, about the role of the body in philosophy. And I showed an interest in that. And he said, well, look,
what do you mean the role of the body?
Well, philosophy is generally about, and traditionally has been about, the soul, or the mind, or the psyche, or nous in ancient Greek, or it's something non-corporeal. It's whatever about us is not the body, and the body has a kind of it gets a bit of a bad rap in philosophy. Plato calls it company, and obviously Christianity. Well, not obviously, but Christianity is rather harsh on the body. A sort of potted history of...
Mark, you've just disappeared. Are you still there? Oh dear, I think we might have lost Mark.
Was very under the spell of Derrida at the time, so it was a little bit.
Mark, are you using the Wi-Fi from the bar where you are?
I'm sorry.
Are you on Wi-Fi?
Yeah.
Could you get closer to the router, the modem, because you disappeared for about 20 seconds there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Get as close to the router as possible. That would be very good.
Okay. That's about as close as I can get, I think.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. So you were saying about the body gets a traditionally gets a. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Could you go indoors maybe? I don't know. I mean that's going to be really distracting.
Okay. There is just no way around this. It's just the setup here. This is the third world, and I just can't do anything about this.
That's unfortunate.
All I can do.
We'll persevere. So you were saying about the role of the body. It has got a bad rap in philosophy.
It has got a bad rap, and then it has got a bad rap in classical philosophy and Christianity. When you start to get onto people like Nietzsche, like Merleau-Ponty, it begins to sort of make its presence felt a little bit more than it did. I don't know if you got that, but Plato calls the body this shadow that keeps us company.
Right.
And by the time... And there's a fascinating... I'll just stop when something goes by. There's a fascinating... there's probably a whole thesis to be written on Freud and the body. Freud started off... I don't know if you're aware, but Freud started as a neurobiologist. I think his doctoral thesis was on the neural system of the catfish or something similar. So really it was about... And as I don't know if you got this, but I was very under the spell of Derrida at the time and deconstruction and the difference between writing and speech, which Derrida says, he sort of allies writing with the body, the dead letter, and so on, and speech with the soul, with fully present communication, signification. So yeah, that's my doctorate thumbnail sketch of.
Right, and we were going to speak about the role of the university, because you recently wrote an essay that was published on Countercurrents. I've actually forgotten what it was titled, but it was about the glass beads game.
Yep.
We can go into that, but first, how would you define? Because I think in our age, in the present age, we don't really know what the university is for, other than training people for a career, giving them the knowledge that they need. Very sort of very black and white, really. But I think historically, and up until about 100 years ago, the university was conceived as something more vague than that, more nebulous. There's more to do with forming someone's a young man's character. Would you like to go into that?
Yes, it was. Well, given that the oldest, best known universities are Oxford and Cambridge, which I think really started off around the 13th centuries. I think in those days it was becoming apparent that a locus was needed for knowledge. It wasn't good enough just for people to pick, because of course, well, when was Gutenberg's printing press? 1450 or something like that. And I guess after that would be with more of a proliferation of printed material. Apart from anything else, the university became a place of libraries. You know, became a place where you would have a locus or a collection of knowledge and information, which really didn't exist before, I suppose. I mean, after the famous Alexandrian Library. I don't know now if what disturbs me is that the university is being seen now again as the formation of a young person's character. Unfortunately, that character has been predetermined by some fairly fierce and sort of neo-Marxist ideology. The classic phrase being that young people at university are now not taught how to think, but taught what to think.
Yes. Yes.
Which does completely obviate the whole point of it. But then, of course, that's split into two because there's the art side, the humanities side, and also the STEM side of things, which the current sort of wokeism or whatever shorthand we want to use for it hasn't affected STEM because it can't really. Although they've made a good effort to try and you know, say that engineering is sexist and mathematics is racist and so on and so forth. But the hard sciences are, still manage to resist that. But the humanities now are pretty much, you know, ideological training courses. They're not. You are not going to university now to learn how to think. To get the apparatus of rational thought, post-Enlightenment stuff, the use of reason. You're really going there to be told what you can and can't say once you leave.
Well, also there's the conception of education itself. I believe uh-huh. that the roots of the word mean to bring out of a person what is already within them.
Educare in Latin. I'm not sure of the Greek for it, but yes, you're absolutely right. To bring forth.
Whereas we now think of education as very well, just basically indoctrination, forcing stuff into a person and changing what is there already, which is very different.
It is, and absolutely ruinous. Because, as I say, STEM is a different thing, and not something I know a great deal about in terms of the disciplines. On the humanities side, and I've been trying to get something into the mainstream media, although I don't think they'll touch me with a long pole now. I think they check who you write for before they even consider you. But I think probably most of the humanities degrees in most of the British universities certainly are near useless now, except for racking up a vast debt.
Well, there's an interesting contradiction that this leftist notion of education involves indoctrinating and forcing stuff into the person, whereas at the same time they have this notion that man is inherently good. So it really they're all about what is natural, what is there, like the sexuality, gender identity. They pretend to be dead against social constructs and things that are artificial, and yet they have so little interest in what is already there in a person's mind, you know, that the person that they inherently are and want to indoctrinate. This is a strange contradiction.
It is, and it's a fault line within the whole idea of wokeism or CRT or any of the different sort of, you know, arms of the huge squid that's covering education at the moment. There's an argument, for example, that race is a social construct. Which is not even an argument. I mean, it's an absurd thing to say. And negates biology and so on and so forth. Except when it comes to white people, when it's not a social construct. It's a very definite thing that exists in the world. It's this clash of intersectionalities, you know, that the left haven't quite mastered. Partly because they don't have the post-Enlightenment apparatus that allows you to pass, a P-A-R-S-E, pass, different ideas and different concepts. The whole idea I don't know if you read a piece of mine on Professor Kathleen Stock, who became quite famous in Britain. She was at my university at Sussex, and she was hounded out of her job. For being what we'd call a gender realist, you know, that boring old stuff about there being two sexes, and although you can change if you do have body dysmorphia or whatever it is, you can't actually change your sex, your biological sex, not simply because you know, people are defined by what they have between their legs or whether they have hairy chests or not. But, I mean, men are men and women are women down to the cellular level. You know, it's not just your whole DNA is shot through with being male or female. And yes, I do appreciate that. Well, hermaphrodites aside, that's a separate thing. I don't really understand much about it, but there is biological hermaphroditism, if that's the word. But Kathleen Stock, Professor Stock, simply said in, I think, a book of hers called Material Girls, and in some of her lectures as well, that, you know, basically men are men and women are women. And she wasn't just debated or questioned. She was, this is the thing now, it just becomes a witch trial straight away. There's no room for, well, let's talk about this. The left will not debate.
Well, at this point, they have arrived at an ideology and a doctrine that they have absolutely no interest in augmenting, except to make it more pure, a more doctrinaire version of itself.
Yes, yes, yes. And it's, in the end, of course, it becomes the doctrine and the adherence to the doctrine that becomes the important thing, rather than the you know, any intellectual fibre that might be contained within the ideas under question or so on. It's just happened to another. I was at Sussex, and so was Kathleen Stock, and that Essex, obviously, you know where Essex is, I assume you do. Although you're Scottish, I gather, by your accent. There we are.
Yes, yes, I'm from Edinburgh.
But okay. That's where you have the brogue, not the rougher, a bit more Glaswegian accent.
Yes, indeed.
Anyway, there's another lady called Jo Phoenix. She's a professor as well, I think. And the same thing has just happened to her. And funnily enough, and this is what I meant by the intersectionalities, both those ladies, here and they take the baffles out because they think that it's going to make the bike go extraordinary thing. Both these professors, both these ladies are women for a start, which, you know, should get you some points on the intersectionality table, and they're also both lesbians.
Oh, even better.
But, yeah, so you'd think that they scored pretty highly, but there's a pecking order is starting to emerge now. In the whole, you know, yes, you're gay, but and let's say perhaps that, Islam has a problem with homosexuality, which in part is quite clear that it does. Okay, well, I'm afraid Islam trumps. It's like those trump cards that the kids play with in the playground. You know, this is going to trump that.
Yes.
So intersectionality will eat itself. Or it will clash with itself in an irreconcilable way. There was quite an interesting thing happened in England, or probably going back a year now or so. They decided that they started to teach to quite small children, I thought quite worryingly small children, about transgenderism and LGBTQ and so on and so forth. And parents began to gather at the school gates on a daily basis to protest, to demonstrate about this. But it was Muslim parents. And that was very interesting to me. Two of the great identity groups, LGBTQ and Islam, suddenly white liberals had to choose between them.
Indeed.
Who to throw under the bus. So it was an uneasy standoff. But because, of course, a lot of people forget that Muslims, well, sorry, that's I can't say a blanket thing like that, but Islamic political tendencies is not just conservatives, it's hyper-conservative. You know, so somebody coming along and saying, right, we're going to give your children, Mohammed and Sanisha, lessons about, read by a drag queen, that's not going to go down well with Muslim families.
Where do you envisage this going? I mean, is this something that has the left genuinely not foreseen this, or do they have a plan?
I don't think they do have a plan. I think they're high on the moment. They're riding the wave of their success because the left pretty much runs Britain now. It's very strange. If you look at any, certainly on the public sector side, and the private sector are having to fall into step with this now. any area of British life, academia, the media, the public sector, social services, etc., etc., you'd have a very, very tough time getting a job there if you were felt to have any conservative leanings. You know, so you said something just then which made me think, well, yes, do the left have a plan for this? No, I don't think they do, but what I do think is, and I use this too much, and I think a lot of people are starting to use it, but Horace, the Roman writer in the Epistles, writes, you can throw nature out with a pitchfork, but she will always come back.
Right. I mean, obviously, this is relevant to communism.
Sorry, carry on.
Well, obviously, this is relevant with communism, mm-hmm. In the 20th century. But there's also, like, now we've got the transhumanist stuff coming in, and I wonder if that this is another example where nature will just hit back in some way, that the genetic engineering that they do will turn out to be fatal. I don't know, and nature will triumph again. And it's not that I even want that necessarily. I'm just saying, maybe that will be how it plays out.
Well, that is to venerate nature, of course. But then, on the other hand, I can't think of anything else to venerate. You know, it's again, who was the science fiction writer? Philip K. Dick, I think it was. He said, reality is the thing that when you ignore it, it doesn't go away.
I love this quote. This is a really useful quote. Right? Mm. I think it's, reality is that which, when you stop believing in it, doesn't go away.
Yes. That's it.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, and it won't. And the trouble is, if you're going to inculcate a whole generation of students into this strange, twisted, non-logic and anti-rational type of thought, who are you unleashing on the world?
Because they are going to be the managers and leaders of, you know, tomorrow.
Exactly. These students will come out of the university, and they won't be going backpacking in Guatemala. They'll be the head of your local council, or they'll be a professor at your university, or they're going to, and eventually, of course, some of them will be politicians. And once that gets into the political stream, wow, that's going to really pollute.
I think we're already there, though. I mean, the generation of managers that we now have, and producers on TV, commissioning editors in the media, mm-hmm. and so on.
Oh, that's true. Yeah,
they're already of the mind that, you know, there's no such thing as male and female. There's no such thing, mm-hmm. as race. Etc., etc. I don't really know how much worse it could be 20 years from now, but I dare say that they will find a way to surprise me.
I think, funnily enough, the saving grace might be the private sector. I remember reading an interview, it must have been a dozen or 15 years ago, with one of the heads of, now what are they called? CBI, Confederation of British Industries. And even then, and this is going back to the start of this century, start of this millennium, he was asked about, you know, the university students he was having coming, or he and his colleagues were having, coming for jobs. And he said, to be absolutely honest with you, they are utterly useless. Not just because they've never been given any behavioural parameters. They've never been given any idea that, you know, you're supposed to work hard, and you're supposed to have some discipline, and you're supposed to be on time and all that kind of stuff. But also because they can't think straight. They can't, you know, you give them a propositional problem, or they don't have, well, I mean, he didn't say this, but I've sort of drawn on that whole idea that eventually employers will just say, look, we're not going to take people on like this who can't think straight, who haven't got the apparatus of post-enlightenment reason. They don't know about, you know, the law of excluded middle. They don't know cause and effect. Funnily enough, I was reading something or listening to something today about, now I can't remember where this was, but it had something to do with American academia, and it was a lobby group, a kind of black caucus, I suppose, or something like that, in the academic world, that have just published this short piece about, look, educate. The problem with education is it's essentially white, and so everything that goes with it is white, and therefore it's racist, because, as you know, everything that's now in any way connected with whiteness or its history is just daubed with a big cross on the door. You know, racism lives here. And there were things like, you know, timekeeping is a white thing. You know, turning up on time and stuff like that. And
well,
how are you going to do? How are you going to do in the workforce? You must have seen this whole thing about mathematics being racist. And so instead of trying to up the standard, they drag the standard they've just stopped advanced mathematics courses in some universities because.
Yes, and there's also the stuff about the gifted program.
Way outperforming blacks and well.
Sorry, and similarly, there's the axing of gifted schools programs in America. I don't know if that's happened elsewhere yet, but they're getting rid because that's massively white, East Asian, and I guess Ashkenazi Jewish. And of course, so that destroys that whole avenue by which, I mean, it's like the destruction of the grammar schools and, you know, merging them into comprehensives, or merging them into secondary moderns to form comprehensives. That clearly that destroys an avenue by which the higher could be nurtured and helped. I mean, it's really evil.
And there's been a key little, event in the description of this type of activity quite recently, and in the last couple of years I've noticed this, which is the changing of the word equality, which essentially means equality of opportunity. Sorry about that, particular racket going on. And they've changed it into something called equity, which really, when you read it, unpacks as equality of outcome. So in other words, you've got to have equality of outcome, which is absurd. If you say you've got to have equality of outcome, you're denying every idea of hierarchy, natural hierarchies, hierarchies of intelligence, the whole IQ argument, which is a very knotty one anyway, because IQ, as good an indicator, performance indicator as it is not, you know, it's not across the board for a personality. Somebody with a high IQ can be... hopeless at I'm an excellent case in point.
we're all absent-minded in different ways, but yeah, I know what you mean, but still it's clearly a useful metric, and it's interesting how much it is denied. But
yes,
of course the big lie here is that the very people who deny it will themselves be proud that they have a high IQ. I mean, it's such delusion.
There is nothing that I think I know that a lot of the little catchphrases and buzzwords and penny phrases that have come over in the last 5-10 years, but the best one, I think the most descriptive one, is virtue signaling. I think that just says that says exactly what it means. There is nothing better for a certain type of person than to be able to stand there and say, "I've got my medals. I've got my, you know, but I believe in the right things."
Of course, but do you not think that such people must always have existed in great numbers? You see, this is an interesting thing for me because it's an example of a modern phenomenon that must just be an iteration of something perennial, surely. People have always cared. I mean, we've always had the do-gooders, the moralists, the preachy types, school marms, the church ladies, this kind of thing. Wonder go on.
Yeah, I was just going to say that if you look back over sort of 18th, 19th century novels across Europe, you know, Zola or Dickens or Thomas Hardy, or just, you know, basically. Throw a dart blindfolded into the dartboard of novelists, and you will find exactly that social striation, including people who are not particularly as worthy as they think they are, but they have either the social standing, it's probably more social standing with what I'm talking about, in something like Zola's novels or Flaubert or something like that, than than what it's become now, which is because, of course, the mass media allows you to virtue signal to millions of people, not just the people in your local church.
Yes.
And the more people can applaud you, the more you're going to want to parade your inherent goodness.
Yes, and if with social media, an ordinary person could garner, you know, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands.
Oh, absolutely.
In rare cases, even hundreds of thousands of people who can then give them adulation. And it's, you know, it's a human thing to enjoy adulation, but it does divorce you from, you know, the everyday. And of course, for some people, it's just dopamine. It's just it's a massive.
Yes, that's right. Spike, that's right. Yeah, know? Yeah.
And then they'll say anything in order to get the adulation, mm-hmm. in order to continue it coming. And of course, in our age, there is a program of opinions. Like a menu to choose from of things that you can say every day on social media that will get you that adulation. It's not even,
there's
no mystery to it. I mean, there's no struggle. There's no, I'll have to work this out myself and then bravely say it, which will go against the social paradigm and I'll be taking a risk. It's completely open. It's completely, everyone knows what you're allowed to say and what you should applaud and what you can expect to be applauded for. But then on top of that, there's then the pretension that it's not like that at all. And when somebody says, mm-hmm. like, that they're pro-gay or something, then they're being brave by saying that.
That's right. The people who think they are the resistance, who are in fact the establishment now.
A lot of what
I heard described as the be nice or no be kind social media brigade, you know, that just say that's all we need to do, just be kind to each other. They are the most rabid pack of snarling, snapping wolves. If anybody steps outside of the,
absolutely, I mean, this is something I've noted for several years now, that there is far more hate on the left, and I don't really.
Oh yes.
Yeah, I'm not sure if these terms are applicable really anymore, but we'll use them for convenience.
They work as a shorthand until we have something better to come along. Yeah.
And there is far more hate among, like, the Champagne Socialists, the Antifa. They are riddled with hatred. Whereas I think on the far right, or in the nationalist sphere, there really isn't that much hate. I mean, there are people who are indelicate, there are people who are angry, there are people like that, but most of us aren't like that. I think most of us just want a sane world.
The whole idea of hate speech as well. It's so. I don't know if you've ever known anyone who. You know, you say something to them or voice an opinion, and they don't just say, "Well, I'm not sure if I agree with you." They just go from 0 to 60 in 3 seconds. It happened to an English journalist called Rod Liddell recently. Do you know Liddell? Rod Liddell,
yes.
He writes for the Spectator.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. He's an okay guy. He's affable and he's rightish. Although he's in the SDP, I think. But he was cancelled, or whatever they call it, deplatformed from a local university, or from a British university, and he was saying, you know, the same type of thing as Professor Stock and Phoenix were, which is men are men and women are women, and it's what we grew up with. And they immediately said this is hate speech.
That's just remarkable. You know, if you went back to the 90s and said that to affirm the gender binary will be regarded as hate speech, no one would believe you, I don't think.
Not just contentious or worthy of debate or even, you know, slightly to be sniffed at, but actual hate speech. It means you hate transgender people or whatever. It's just an extraordinary idea. But it is, of course, the way that these movements gain traction. You know, I remember 20 odd years ago when I last worked in an office, some of my views on things got me some odd looks in the office and maybe occasional cold shoulder at after work drinks or something. And that's when I first remember noticing the phrase for fear of being branded racist, which became a very, you know, almost a banner under which a lot of public sector bodies sailed for a long time, and still do, in fact. But now it's far more serious than that. You know, now I probably would have lost my job for saying that some of the things I said about Islam or whatever it might be. It's changed. The power has become frightening, really, even for the uncancellable. I'm sure you're aware of the whole furore around, who's the Harry Potter woman? J.K. Rowling.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, and it's the same as Germaine Greer, even.
Yeah. But not only, yes, of all people. She would never have predicted that happening, I don't think. Or old Germaine Greer. But not only did J.K. Rowling sort of get socially, I mean, you can't cancel her. She's a third richest woman in the world or something ridiculous. Some of these people are uncancelled in terms of you can't cost them their career. You can just shun them. But they didn't stop at that. They had photographs of protesters outside her house with the address clearly visible. You know, the veiled implication being, you know, come and smash some windows, everybody.
Yeah. I mean, in her case, she can easily afford the necessary security. I'm sure she could afford multiple teams of security squads, security guys to keep her safe. But
who wants to have to live like that?
You know. Well, exactly. And for other people, such luxuries are completely impossible.
Yes.
And this is the threat of the mob in this day and age, that they can, you know, I had a similar thing where Antifa came to my house. It was a long time ago now. It was nearly 5 years ago. And they didn't do a protest or anything. They just came to the house. And, you know, that's frightening enough. If that's never happened to you, it's a scary, very unsettling thing.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
That's, and I'm, you know, that is something that, you know, it amazes me that Antifa never, I don't know, it doesn't really amaze me. It's because I know, I understand why they get away with it. But still, it's galling. And it also amazes me that, and it really does.
Yeah, it is.
That they don't realize themselves, that they don't think, hold on, I'm doing a really shitty thing here. But this is the luxury of being on the winning side. You don't need to question yourself.
Yeah, that's the luxury of being on the winning side. And it's also the fabulous feeling that you get of being in lockstep. You know, I think the right things, those people think the wrong things. Therefore, it's their house. We're gonna you know, turn up at and give a hard time to. And not only that, it's not even, you know, you don't have to stand up and say, okay, I've got a problem with transgenderism, or I've got a problem with this, or I've got a problem with that. There's a band, I'm sure you heard about this as well. I never heard of this band, Mumford and Sons. I've heard of them, but I'd never heard them. No idea what they're like. But their banjo player, I think they're a sort of folky band. Their banjo player or something like that tweeted or put on Facebook that he was reading a book by Andy Ngo, or Ngo, however you pronounce it.
Yes.
The very brave American journalist who got hospitalized with brain bleeding by Antifa in Portland, I think. But this guy just said, I've just been reading this great book about Antifa. And wow, that was it. Out the band, off social media. It just immediately pounce, you know, like guard dogs. It's remarkable.
I mean, it's like the kind of thing you hear about, that you would associate that with Soviet level control of public opinion.
And that's a real worry. If it goes down that road, then
it almost doesn't need to, because we've already got that level. I mean, that level of control is pretty damn high. You know, you can see what's going on there. And actually, something that I wanted to put to you specifically was that in Britain and you know, the West in general, we used to have the expression, it's a free country. Whereas no one says that anymore.
Yes, that's right.
You know, it used to be a sort of casual thing that people would say jokingly, but everyone knew that it was true, and it was a banality. It was funny to say it because it was so obvious and just and we live in a free country. Yes,
I remember in the 1970s. I remember my parents' friends in the 1970s saying it. You heard it on situation comedies all the time, and it was a rhetorical question, the answer being, yes, of course it's a free country. The answer now is no, it absolutely isn't.
Yeah, and I think that people have internalized I was just going to say,
and that leads on to one more thing, which once you...
Oh, I think we've lost McGinnell.
Yes. Sorry. You look to politicians and the media to defend. Oh, sorry. Yes, I was just going to say that once you feel free speech is under threat,
Oh dear. Let's see what happens. I'm sure he will be back. It'll just be about... I know that he's outdoors just now, so that's probably the cause of all this. But, come on, let's see. Ah, dear. Mark, can you hear me? Oh, he's disappeared. Okay. Oh, no, that's a shame. What I'll probably do is keep this one fairly short once he comes back so that we'll just get it wrapped up. I'll ask the questions that have been posted on Entropy. And there are two of those. And I don't think... No, there aren't any on Odyssey. It's a shame because he's such an interesting guy and clearly has a lot to say, but I'll try to persuade him to get a better setup together for these kinds of things, because I think he should be doing more of this. I think he's a really worthwhile speaker, but I don't think he realizes that. Some people are like that. They don't realize they'd be good at this stuff until they do it. Let's see what's happening. I'll see if he sent me an email. No, he's not showing up. That's a real shame. Oh, someone says, thank you, Galileo's tongue. As he says, he seems like a nice bloke. Where can I hear more from him? How did you find him, Moz? Well, he writes for Countercurrents, and Greg did a stream earlier this year. I think it was the 10th anniversary of Countercurrents, and he did a celebratory stream. And he had a lot of his writers appeared on that voice only. And for most of them, I think it was the first time they'd ever done anything like that. And one of them was Mark Gullick. And that was how I first heard of him. Now, I think I might have read some of his essays before then, but thereafter I was aware of him as a person. There was a sort of voice to go with the name. And so I made a point of, because I liked what he was saying on that stream. I find him quite a likable guy, affable and interesting. So I looked out for his essays thereafter, and I read about five of his essays since then, and he's a he really is a bloody good writer. He did one about 1984. He did one about the university. He's done several recently that I've read. And here he is.
I'm back.
Hello.
Hi. Sorry about that. I think that's this end. This again, it's third world internet, and it does just drop in and out.
Okay. Well, let's. We've been going for 45 minutes, so which is just usually about the average for the millennial streams. I'll ask you a few questions that have been posted.
By all means.
Okay, these are quite different from what we were talking about earlier. Mark, were you educated in the analytic tradition that began with G.E. Moore?
The only thing I know about Moore, funnily enough, well, no is the answer. No, absolutely not. I steered very clear of logic and anything along those lines, anything mathematical. The only thing I know about Moore, or am I thinking of Bradley? Who was the one that was the influence on T.S. Eliot? One of those two. I'd probably put my foot in it there. I think that might have been Bradley, not Moore. No, I wasn't, basically. I really came up through the classics and then did a fast forward to existentialism when I was doing my first degree. And that sort of set the mould for the rest of my studies.
Right, okay. So the rest of it was who are some of your favourite analytic philosophers, but I'm guessing you don't have many.
Not really, no. No. Not my area of expertise, if anything is. I don't know, analytical, it depends. If that's a specific school, then I'd probably put my foot in it if I said that I was very interested in Wittgenstein, who I find analytical, but I don't know if that's what the questioner means by an analytical school.
He said analytic, which suggests it's a specific field, but I think
you might be right, yes.
And then the other question was, Mark, you said that you knew a member of Killing Joke back when you worked as a bartender. Who was he, and did you ever see Killing Joke's live gigs?
Not quite true that I knew him. I did live with a member of the Clash for a while, but I didn't know a member of Killing Joke. But the chap I was referring to was Geordie Walker, tremendous guitarist, and I walked into a bar in Brighton one night where I was at university. That's where Sussex is, and there was Geordie Walker. He's about 6'3", and he's very, very, very stands out. And he just got me completely drunk all night, wouldn't let me pay for a drink. And he told me that I said, look, you've got to let me buy you a drink. He said, no, we're drinking the royalties for Love Like Blood, which is probably their most famous single. So,
I see.
That's my Geordie Walker story.
Okay. And you also met Ian Curtis, of course.
I did meet Ian Curtis, yes.
Yeah, you did a wonderful essay about Joy Division.
Well, that was, and I think the story is included in that. I just had a half an hour, 45-minute chat with him. And the nicest thing about that, well, it was a bit bittersweet, really, because, of course, he has such a tragic end. The nicest thing about that was I went to see them again in London a couple of weeks later, and he recognized me and called out to me and said, hey, Mark, how you doing? Which was now I look back on it. Some people think, my God, that's legendary. You met Ian Curtis, but a charming man and very tragic. But yes, I did write a piece about that, which would have been in May, I suppose, because that was the anniversary of his death.
Yeah, it's a shame. I do wonder what they would have gone on to do.
I really do. I wonder whether the band would have gone down the New Order route, you know, into electronica and so on. I wonder whether, because when you listen to Blue Monday, it's his vocal style. It's just not over bass guitar and drums. It's over, you know, kind of pulsing electronica beat. So I wonder what he's done, yes.
Yeah, I remember hearing an interview with, I think it was Bernard Sumner, who said that after his suicide, they made a decision to go upbeat. In which case, you know, had he lived, then they probably wouldn't have gone upbeat and more New Order territory.
Yeah,
and I do think that Closer is just a fantastic album.
Oh, it's brilliant. And you can tell from the, I think the first New Order album was called Movement. And you can tell that those songs were, in fact, I recognized some of the songs from, I saw them live about six times. Oh, I forgot to tell your question. I saw Killing Joke three times, was the answer to that question. They were a staggering band to see live. The first time I saw them was at my university, and they came through the audience with these sort of flaming torches and so on. It was, and you know, kind of primitive dancers bouncing around them and stuff. They were quite something else. But no, the first New Order album, Movement, was obviously Joy Division work in progress, which Sumner took over.
Yeah, yeah. I have listened to it, but I haven't studied it. But I've heard people say it. It does feel quite like a Joy Division album, or at least a midway point between the two. Mm-hmm. Okay, there's a question for you that's just come in. Have you ever come across J.M.E. McTaggart's The Unreality of Time?
No, not at all. Don't recognise the name, nor do I recognise the book. No.
Okay.
But I should certainly...
And there's another one. Or Timothy Sprigg's The Vindication of Absolute Idealism.
No, I haven't. I would love it if the questioners could email those to you and you could bounce them on to me, though, because I'll always take a recommendation.
Okay, I'll send those on to you. All right, then. Well, let's wrap it up there.
Sure.
I'm sure we can talk forever.
Listen, Colin, my apologies for the standard of the... of the broadcast. I hope it hasn't been too rough.
No,
if we do this again, I will. I mean, I'm in the process of. It is very, very difficult here. I live in a place where there's about five apartments, but I'm the only one living here, so I can't to get the internet set up just for my apartment is impossible because I'm not a resident. You have to be a resident, and my landlady doesn't do it. So I piggyback on the cafe next door, which I probably won't say too loud in case they're in. So I hope it wasn't too rough for you. And thanks ever so much for talking me through all this stuff. I wouldn't have been able to do it otherwise.
That's fine. And thank you for taking the effort. I do appreciate it. And this has been
You're more than welcome. I'm a great admirer of yours as well. I've watched a few of your debates and speeches and lectures and so on. And you have a very measured approach to the way that you take on ideas. What's your academic background, by the way?
Oh, I don't have one, really. I went to art college.
Surprised you didn't form a band.
Well, yeah. But it just wasn't really academic. You know, I can't really tell you anything that I learned there. So it's kind of like four wasted years. But that was also in London.
Right. Just one point I wanted to finish with, because it's such an important point. You know Jonathan Bowden, or Bowden, I'm never quite sure how you pronounce it.
Bowden, I think.
Yeah. He said that he thought Countercurrents was an online university.
Yes.
And I've said to a few people recently, not that I know any 18-year-olds, if you know any 18-year-olds, or if you've got a kid who's 18, and they want to go to university to do a humanities degree, try everything you can short of physically locking them up to stop them doing that. If they just took £100 and went to half a dozen charity shops, picked books at random which interested them, in 3 years' time, they'll probably be much, much more employable than somebody who's done gender studies or whiteness studies or, you know, whatever the faddish thing is there. You're just better off.
And in the meantime, they should read Countercurrents. I agree.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Countercurrents put me onto a load of stuff I had never heard of, never read. And you know, as I say, I've just heard of the titles of two books and authors that I've never heard of before. So that's worked for me tonight as well.
All right, well, I'll send those on to you. Okay, well, we'll end this one here. So thank you, Mark Gullick, for appearing on Millennial 2021. Okay.
Thank you very much. Have a lovely Christmas. And
okay.
Thank you for inviting me. All right.
Too. Thank you very much.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Millennial Woes has created many things, and this is your chance to own one of them. A unique piece of work handcrafted by the Vile Vlogger to commemorate Millennial 2021.
100 hours of highly skilled labour went into producing this animated vector graphic, which can be magnified to any size. In the iconic Millennial Woes font, it glistens and responds to your touch. And at the centre of it all, a figure representative of 2021, the White Stag, symbolising endurance, discovery, and rejuvenation. This one-of-a-kind creation is up for sale as an NFT. Follow the link below, and it can be yours forever. This is your only chance.